A note to listeners, the following podcast contains content that may not be suitable for all audiences. Discretion is advised.
Became very aware that certain crimes and certain individuals become iconic in our popular culture. And certainly serial killers, the likes of Ted Bundy and the Son of Sam and the Zodiac fall into that category. And I became very fascinated by why is that? I think inherent in the human condition, a desire to understand behavior that just seems so reprehensible and so horrible. We have a need to understand it, to try to comprehend it. And serial killers sort of are at the extreme end of what a human being could do to another.
You are listening to Partners in True Crime. We are your hosts, Rob and Cindy Dorfman. Today, we're very excited to launch a new podcast that will explore the world of serial killers and true crime with a renowned criminologist, Dr. Scott Bond. Dr. Scott Bond has a unique perspective on serial killers because not only does he study them and write books about them, but he also talks to them frequently.
Scott has been communicating with notorious serial killers for years, like Dennis Rader, otherwise known as BTK, who terrorized the state of Kansas for 3 decades.
He has also studied and talked with David Berkowitz, the Son of Sam killer, who had hardcore New Yorkers frightened to go out at night after he killed and wounded 15 people in the mid-70s.
We will also be bringing in experts from the true crime world to help us explore and understand what drives these killers to commit these horrific acts of violence.
And to find out why we love serial killers, which, by the way, is the title of Scott Bond's best-selling book. Without further ado, it's time to start The Killing Hour with Doc Bond. All right, so this is really exciting. Cindy and I have a new guest and also going to be the co-host to this really interesting podcast that we're going to kick off here. And we want to introduce Dr. Scott Bond. And we met Scott probably, a few months ago? Full disclosure, we're developing a television show with Scott, too. He has an amazing book out. It's Why We Love Serial Killers. And it's, Scott, it's still out there and people can buy it?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. Cool. I just wanted to welcome you to Partners in True Crime. Cindy, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I think this book is pretty awesome. And when you reached out to us and I read this book and I said to Rob, oh my God, this is exactly what we've been looking for, someone who can kind of get us into the mind of a serial killer and kind of understand why we're obsessed with this as a culture and how it affects culture, being obsessed with serial killers. And the relationship that you've built with some of these serial killers is also fascinating, and I'd love to get into that at some point too. So why don't we start with you telling us a little bit about yourself and let people know how you got into this and why you decided to write this book. I'll let you take it from there.
Sure. Well, likewise, I'm really happy to be working with the two of you. I feel like I found the right partners to do this. People have been suggesting that I do a podcast for a while, but when I met the two of you, it seemed like kismet. I'm a sort of a non-traditional criminologist, I would say, because the first 20 years of my professional career were spent in the advertising and media fields. And if I go all the way back to my undergraduate years at Kent State University in Ohio, I reached sort of an academic crossroad. I was equally enamored and fascinated by advertising as well as the criminal mind, and I was torn. Which way do I want to go? Do I want to major in advertising and consumer behavior and marketing and what drives people to make the purchases that they do, as well as the dark side of the human condition and making choices to do very bad things, as of course serial killers do. And at the time, I opted for the money and the shorter route, and I went into advertising for 20 years and was pretty successful at it, and actually spent some time at NBC Television Network, where I was a vice president in marketing. As part of that journey, I was working with the folks in the news organization, and I saw firsthand how the news operation is really no different than a primetime episode of Seinfeld, which is what was at the time that I was there, was the hottest show, and a news story in terms of the ability to draw in an audience. And there's an old journalistic adage, if it bleeds, it leads. And that's all equally true in television. The more sensationalized a story is, the more likely it is it's going to draw in viewers. And the more viewers you have, then the more you can charge for advertising. interesting. I became very aware that news is not inherently news. It's news because it appeals to someone and it draws an audience. And I became very intrigued by that. And after about 20 years in advertising, right around 9/11, I reached a point where I was ready to make a change. And I really wanted to explore that other fascination that I had. And that was, you know, with more of the dark side of the human condition and explore the criminal mind. So I went back to school, got a master's degree in criminal justice initially, and then got a PhD in sociology, concentrating in criminology. And so I began this exploration of the criminal mind, but I did it through sort of a news and media perspective. And what I mean by that is I became very aware that certain crimes and certain individuals become iconic in our popular culture. And certainly serial killers, the likes of Ted Bundy and the Son of Sam and the Zodiac fall into that category. And I became very fascinated by why is that? You know, why is that? Why do we almost glorify in certain ways these individuals? And what is it about that, you know, that draws us to this? And what I found is I became a college professor. And as I was teaching my classes, it was the discussion of serial killers that always got my students on the edges of their seats and riveted with every word that came out of my mouth. Ultimately, it was probably their interest and their fascination that led me to say, you know what? I want to do some research on this. I'm going to approach the police. I'm going to talk to them about it. I'm going to talk to the public about it. I'm going to talk to journalists about it. And I'm even going to approach the serial killers themselves, especially the self-promoting types of serial killers like Son of Sam and Dennis Rader, BTK, and find out why this is. You know, why does this phenomenon exist? Why do we seem to love serial killers? Which, of course, led to the title of the book. So it was a combination of my sort of marketing background, the idea that these individuals are self-promoters and marketers in their own way. And I'm talking about, you know, Bundy and Rader and the Zodiac, et cetera. They were craving attention. My background in marketing and advertising combined with my training in criminology and the criminal mind led me to, you know, focus on this very specific area. It led to writing a book, Why We Love Serial Killers, The Curious Appeal of the World's Most Savage Murderers, that has had, I'm very happy and humbled to say, a real crossover appeal. This book is used at universities. It's used in communications departments, sociology departments, criminal justice departments within the universities. And it's also had a nice crossover appeal with the general public, who are just fascinated with this phenomenon and with serial killers. So that's a bit of background on the, you know, the whole thing.
What do you think is the main reason why we're obsessed with this, or people are obsessed with serial killers? Do you think it's because of the lore of the monster that we're all afraid of, or the fact that how can a human being go from being living a normal life like Gary Ridgway did and then becoming this monster on the dark side? And I think we forget about the victims in this, and this is what I really want to make sure that everyone is aware of. People die at the hands of these monsters, innocent victims, and we can't forget them. I understand that these monsters have become part of cultural lore and all these things, but at the end of the day, human beings' lives are lost by these people, and they aren't bigger than life. Most of them that I've talked to and met are really small individuals who want to pretend that they're bigger than life. I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that.
Well, those are great, great comments and questions there, Cindy, and I agree. I mean, they're only grandiose in their own minds, not in reality. The answer to the question of the public's fascination, I think it's multifaceted. There is inherent in the human condition, a desire to understand behavior that just seems so reprehensible and so horrible. We have a need to understand it, to try to comprehend it. And serial killers sort of are at the extreme end of what a human being could do to another. I mean, after you abduct someone, torture them, kill them, and in some cases even have sex with the corpse and eat them, I mean, what's left? I mean, there's really nothing left after that. And these things are so horrifying to us that I think there's a need to comprehend it, because if we can understand it, then it doesn't seem so frightening. You know, and because otherwise it just will keep us sleepless at night. And people have told me this, you know, this very thing. I need to understand it. I need to wrap my mind around it. But ultimately, it is almost inexplicable. I mean, how do you really understand a guy like Dennis Rader? You know, we can categorize him. We can say he's a malignant narcissist and a psychopath and categorize him, but that really doesn't get into the nuances, you know, of his mind and his motivations. And what happens, and this is something that I really am not a fan of, law enforcement and the media and many professionals at the end of the day will say, well, he's just evil. He's pure evil. You know, that's the reason. Why did Dennis Rader do what he did? Well, he's just pure evil. That's just lazy reductionism in my belief. And what I mean by reductionism is it's almost like a stereotype. You know, we're just saying, oh, he does it because of this, you know, inherently evil. And that's a dangerous and slippery slope to go on. Because once you do that, then there's no basis for understanding and there's no need for understanding. It's just, oh, he's evil. Okay. So what do we do with evil? We just destroy it. Without getting off on a tangent, in society and discussion of politics and things like that, people do that all the time. They say, well, the other side is just evil. Okay. Well, if that's true, then how can we have any sort of conversation or discussion? You know, I guess all that's left is to destroy one another, which is, you know, as I said, it's a very slippery slope. But it's the same thing here. I think it's important to understand these individuals because at the end of the day, like it or not, they are human beings. Now, they are human beings who are doing very evil things, but they are human beings. They're part of us. And that also gets to part of the fascination, because I think people, we are empathetic creatures, and there is this inherent need to empathize and understand and to sympathize with other living things, even other living things that are dangerous and frightening. I mean, look, even with animals, thanks to the Discovery Network, we celebrate a shark week. And thanks to the Oxygen Network, we celebrate a serial killer week. You know, these things are part of our consciousness, part of our thought process. So there's a need to understand these individuals. And think even in the case of, I was a big fan of horror movies when I was a kid. And I loved the ones with the sympathetic monsters, the Frankenstein monster, who was, you know, this misunderstood creature just trying to get along in the world. King Kong, you know, the misunderstood gorilla who was just in love, you know, with Fay Wray, the beautiful blonde. Even Dracula, you know, Dracula was if you really look at the old Bram Stoker novels, he was actually a very romantic individual, and his bloodlust only came out of a sense of being wronged and so forth. And we love those complex characters. We love those individuals who seem to have both good and evil aspects to them, which leads to why someone like a Ted Bundy or a Dennis Rader or even a David Berkowitz is so frightening and so compelling, because in many ways they seem so normal. They seem just, you know, an average guy, you know, and if an average guy could do the things that Dennis Rader, BTK, did, my God, then a serial killer could be anybody. It could be my next door neighbor. It could be my brother-in-law. You know, it could be
anyone.
And
it is.
That's crazy. And that's the thing. It's like evil in plain sight.
That's a reality for a lot of these cases. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, when we did Gary Ridgway, he was sitting down at dinner with his family, would leave for an hour, go kill someone, and come back to dinner. Do you classify that as extreme narcissistic psychopath or someone who has no emotions? Like, what is that categorized? What can you call someone who does something like that?
Well, that's a great question. Research suggests that somewhere between 40 to 50% of known serial killers fall into the category of a psychopath. And many of them are also malignant narcissists. And Dennis Rader is the, BTK is the poster boy of all that. Who is the one at the top of the heap there that personifies the bloodthirsty psychopath and malignant narcissist? It is Dennis Rader. And in fact—
Why is that?
Well, let's start with the psychopathy. A true psychopath is an individual that is completely unplugged emotionally and empathetically from other living things. I like to use an analogy. Imagine an electrical cord connected to, let's say, a hairdryer, right? If you pull it out of the wall, it just doesn't work. Well, imagine that with a psychopath. There's an empathy cord and it's just pulled out of the wall, unable to empathize with other living things, humans and animals, et cetera.
So Scott, so I'm going to just jump right in here with some of these questions that we have for you. I think the big question here is, why is society so fascinated by true crime generally and serial killers specifically?
Great question. And it is the one that really preceded and led me to do the research that ultimately ended up being my book, Why We Love Serial Killers. And it is the million-dollar question. And as so many things in life, when you actually dig in and begin to do the investigation and research, you find out that it's a lot more complex than you even originally thought. So there's actually a number of dynamics going on here. And so let's break them down. At one level, there's just the fascination with the dark side of the human condition. And these true crime shows generally are dealing with murder, which is pretty much the worst thing that any human being can do to another. And then when you look at the serial killers, they are at the extreme end. Not only are they killing, but they're killing multiple people. They're doing so in the most horrific ways, in many cases torturing and even killing, mutilating, and eating in some cases. What could possibly be worse? So these stories serve to let us investigate the dark side. And in some ways, it's almost like a mirror reflection of the worst of society and allows us to look in the mirror and say, are there any circumstances whereby I might be able to do something like this? It serves almost like a catalyst or an opportunity to investigate the dark side. And because they're so horrific, they're very frightening. And there's a psychological need to try to understand what these individuals are doing. Because if I can understand it, it seems so incomprehensible. But if I can somehow understand it, then maybe it's not so frightening after all.
Is it like the fact, like when people go on safari and they're looking at these wild animals and they're trying to figure out what makes them tick? These things that are, you're on the precipice of something that's very deadly in front of you.
Well, yeah, that's definitely part of it. And we as humans are intrigued by things that are larger than life and very dangerous and exotic. In fact, I've used the analogy that serial killers are very much like great white sharks. They have three things in common. They're rare, they're exotic, and they're very deadly. In the scheme of killing, they only represent about 1% of all killings, serial killers, and yet they get more than their lion's share of media attention. And think about the human fascination with not only predators like you're talking about in nature, which serial killers are clearly predators in society, but also things that are just larger than life, like tsunamis and earthquakes and tornadoes. There's a fascination with all of these things that are just, that are large and disruptive and compelling. It's almost like rubbernecking on the highway. You know, there's a terrible accident on the side of the road and you don't really want to look at it, but yet you're compelled to, in some way. And we as humans are, I believe, innately motivated and driven to empathize with all living things, whether humans, animals, and whether good or bad. So there's this need to try to understand individuals like BTK and Dahmer and Bundy, etc. And partially, as I said, that it's not so frightening if I can figure it out. But also, when we humanize them, it makes them that much more compelling and fascinating. The most interesting fictional monsters are the ones that have human characteristics and have some empathetic appeal, like King Kong. King Kong is a great example of the misunderstood creature who is just being King Kong and thrust into society and painted as evil. The Frankenstein monster, also. Even Dracula, they have these interesting human characteristics that makes them very appealing. But at the same time, I also argue in my book that there's like this conflicting dynamic. On the one hand, we want to humanize these individuals, but we also want to dehumanize these individuals, because we do want to draw a line, a distinction between good and evil. And what could be more evil than what Jeffrey Dahmer did to his, you know, his victims? So we want to be able to draw the distinction between us and Jeffrey Dahmer. And we do that by portraying him and depicting his actions as those of pure evil. I would go so far as to say that he really delineates the line between man and monster. Jeffrey Dahmer is a perfect example of that, or BTK also delineates that line between man and monster. It makes us feel safe. It makes us feel okay about ourselves. We can, you know, might even say, hey, I may not be the best husband in the world. I may not be the best father, the best friend, but I don't kill and eat people. So it allows us also to feel good about ourselves and truly create the other, if you will.
Hey everyone, if you love reality shows and love to hear all pop culture insider news, you're going to love this podcast.
The Sarah Fraser Show is a daily podcast covering pop culture, reality recaps like Sister Wives, 90 Day Fiancé, and your favorite Bravo shows, plus guests of all kinds. You might learn something too, and a splash of Sarah's own personal life. Hint.
She's trying to have her second baby at 42 and shares every last detail about it, for better or worse.
The Sarah Fraser Show has been featured in the New York Post, Daily Mail, and more.
You might have seen Sarah recently on Lifetime's Married at First Sight kickoff and mid-season show with host Kevin Frazier.
Check out The Sarah Fraser Show today wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Jeffrey Dahmer.
Why do you think that BTK is so, everyone's so fascinated by him particularly? I mean, I know everyone is interested in Dahmer, especially now, but forever, everyone I've ever talked to about serial killers, they always talk about BTK as like the scariest one.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think there's a number of reasons why that is. On the one hand, he is the sort of everyman killer, could be anyone. You know, he's so innocuous. When they finally arrested him, he appears just so bland and innocuous. And in fact, lived the life of the everyman. He was the Lutheran Church president. He was the Boy Scout leader. He was the compliance officer in the city. He, you know, he appeared normal. You know, maybe a little uptight, maybe a little high, you know, high strung, tightly wound. But other than that, you know, perfectly normal. So if that's the case, and he can get away with this for 30 years, that means pretty much anybody could be a serial killer. If Dennis Rader can be a serial killer, then pretty much anyone could. So that's extremely frightening. And so that's, I think that's one aspect of it. And the mere fact that he got away with it for 30 years, most serial killers don't. And he, not only did he get away with it for 30 years, but they only really caught him because of his own ego and he tripped himself up. You know, if he hadn't done that, if he hadn't gotten caught up, you know, through his own egomania, he might still be out there. So that's it. You know, it's really extraordinary that an individual was able to evade capture and prosecution for so long. And the fact that he had such lengthy cooling off periods between his victims, I think, is also rather compelling, because most serial killers don't do that. The period between their killings tends to be much shorter, not months and even years the way his were. And also another aspect of the fascination with him is he is really on the extreme of behavior, you know, in terms of what one person can do to another. And even among serial killers, he's essentially the worst of the worst in every possible way. And as Mark Olshaker told us, and also my conversations with Roy Hazelwood, the late FBI profiler, Rader just manifests so many different personality disorders, narcissism, malignant narcissism, and profound psychopathy, and just a litany of fetishes and sexual deviances that would be enough for several serial killers. And he manifests all of them. So he really is the extreme in that regard. And then the fact that he just has no remorse whatsoever to this very day. He has even said since his capture that he truly believes that his victims are going to serve him as sex slaves in his afterlife. It just shows that his lack of remorse and belief system is still so profoundly pathological.
What can we learn from someone like that? I mean, because some people, the chicken and egg thing as far as with the death penalty, you have all these killers behind bars who have done horrendous things. Logic would have is let's find out why they did it. But I think there's a push and pull on that, because some people really don't feel it. You can't really learn anything. Bad is bad, and evil is evil. And there's been evil since the day of time. So what can we really learn from someone who is basically a predator, a born predator in sheep's clothing, and who has no remorse?
Those are very good questions. And I really don't like the reductionism of the words, you know, evil and monster, because it's really lazy on the part of any investigators, law enforcement, the media, to comprehend. And admittedly, how do you understand an individual like BTK or Dahmer or the others? And so what we end up with is, in order to feel okay and be able to just move on about our day, because we don't like ambiguity, we don't like uncertainty in life, we like to have things, you know, defined. So what do? We just put the stamp of evil and monster on it and then move on, because it allows us to just not suffer in the ambiguity of it. But that just does a tremendous injustice, because that is to say that there is no possibility to understand these individuals, and that there's nothing to be learned from them, and that it can't be a cautionary tale or provide red flags for the future, for the next BTK. Because it's important to remember, these individuals don't just spontaneously erupt out of the, you know, the woodwork. They evolve and progress over time. So if you have a child around adolescence who is acting very callously toward others, is indifferent to the suffering of others, is even shows signs of sadism or preoccupation with death and dead things, like Jeffrey Dahmer did, and also BTK tortured animals. If you have individuals like this, if you have a child that seems to exhibit some of these predispositions, that's a huge red flag. So by studying somebody like BTK, we understand how he evolved. He himself acknowledged that there were certain points where their red flags were raised. Like, for example, the fact that he became sexually aroused when his grandmother killed a chicken on the farm. And he saw the blood squirt at a very early age, 8 or 10 years old, and he became sexually aroused. Well, that's clearly a sign. And as he evolved slowly. He became a peeping Tom. He became a burglar, would break into women's homes and steal their underwear. And it wasn't until 15 years, probably after his initial titillation with violence and arousal, that he acted out and killed his first victims. So I think, you know, by studying these individuals, first of all, we can learn their motivations, we can learn their patterns, how they operate, and we can also delineate and identify these potential landmarks or red flags throughout their development where perhaps an intervention can take place. And then from the victim perspective, is it allows us to become more vigilant. If we understand how these predators stalk their prey and how they hunt, then we as potential victims can become more vigilant and protect ourselves. So I actually think there's a tremendous amount to be learned from these individuals. And I also believe it's extremely dangerous to just put that label of evil on them, even though it might make ourselves feel better by doing it. It really does an injustice and potentially harm, because we don't really understand their true inner workings when we put that reductionistic label on them.
Do you think that there's a danger to giving so much attention to someone like BTK?
To the extent that it is sensationalized or glorified in any way, the answer is yes. And unfortunately, if you go on the internet, you can Google, you know, fan clubs, you can Google merchandise, you can find baby clothes with serial killers' pictures on them. And so to the extent that it's done in an exploitative sort of way, then absolutely. And I believe, and I know that you guys believe, that the victim's plight and the victim's perspective really needs to be front and center, because sadly, and I've done this in the classroom and I've done it with the public, simply said, if you look at BTK and Ted Bundy, together they killed upwards of 50 people. Name one of the victims. Name one. And typically, well, not typically, 100% of the time that I've done this little experiment, I've never gotten an answer. I've never gotten one name. So that's an indication that we as a society do a great job of promoting the killers, but we don't do a very good job of putting the stories of the victims and the plight of the victims front and center. And we mentioned this Netflix that they have, this Dahmer series right now. And it's done quite well. I mean, I, as a criminologist, I would say it's done quite well. However, the producers, I understand, have received quite a bit of criticism because they did not apparently reach out to the families of the victims and the loved ones. And many of them are up in arms. So to the extent that they sit back and are blindsided by a series like that, they have to relive the experiences. It's almost like they're being victimized, you know, again. And that's wrong. That's just wrong. So I think that we have to always think in terms of how will this affect the victims? How can we keep their story and their suffering front and center so that we're not focused or glorifying the killers themselves?
Yeah. Well, we were talking about what we can learn from BTK, and you've illustrated that. But can someone like a BTK and a Dahmer or a Bundy or anybody who killed multiple people, can they actually be rehabilitated and stop that? And can I prevent it? I mean, is there medication that can do it? Because, you know, I did a documentary on the Atascadero State Mental Hospital in California. And I've been to a lot of prisons, and they were scary. But that hospital, which wasn't like a prison, it was just more like, it looked like an old school and just had razor wire around it and fencing. It was probably one of the scariest places I've ever been. Because you had the sexual violent predators there. You had a ton of very severely mentally ill people who were dangerous. So can someone like BTK be rehabilitated?
Well, it's a great question. And I do share your perspective on these, you know, the frightening nature of these facilities. I was at the Sullivan Correctional Facility in the upstate New York, which is where they used to house David Berkowitz. And man, it was a scary sandstone fortress that looked like something out of a horror movie, out of a Dracula movie, something like that. So I definitely identify with that. But it, you know, regarding BTK and regarding his possible redemption or can he be rehabilitated? In his case, the answer is a resounding no, because of his litany of personality disorders. Can any serial killer potentially be rehabilitated? The answer, I believe, would be yes, depending upon their psychological makeup and what it is that they're dealing with. In the case of Rader, you have about as profoundly psychopathic an individual as I can imagine humanly possible. And psychopathy, there is no cure. He was hardwired that way at birth, and he is simply incapable of experiencing the normal range of emotions, and in particular, remorse, pity, sadness, any sort of empathetic feelings at all. He just can't feel them. So the answer is no. He's not mentally ill. He is not mentally ill. These antisocial personality or disorders, including psychopathy, sociopathy, malignant narcissism, these are antisocial personality disorders. They're not mental illness. So he is not delusional per se in terms of he's not having psychotic delusions or that sort of thing. He's simply physically and mentally, psychologically is incapable of, you know, of empathy. Now, what he can be is effectively managed in an environment like a prison. And what I mean by that is he's extremely goal-oriented. He's extremely narcissistic.
Yeah, I know. You said that before. What I'm trying to get to is because, like, when I was up at Tescadero and I interviewed some of these sexual violent predators, some of them who have been chemically castrated,
mm-hmm.
and they even told me that because, you know, they've been sexually, you know, castrated, if he was let out today, the first thing he's going to do is go find a young person and violate them. It's all in the wiring. I think it's just this bad wiring.
Well, as I was saying with BTK, he would do the same thing. I mean, well, he's old and feeble now, so he may not be physically capable of it, but certainly psychologically, the answer is yes. He would want to go and do what he believes that he was born to do, which is kill. So yeah, but again, it's important to mention the fact and explain the fact that not all serial killers are the same. And it really depends upon what it is that they are dealing with psychologically. So somebody, you know, specifically BTK, can he be rehabilitated? The answer is pretty simple. No.
Do you think that the true crime genre serves a purpose other than just for entertainment?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to take a little bit of what I would call a sociological perspective on this. And, you know, I mentioned vigilance once before. So I believe the true crime programming enables people to understand the way that these predators work and how they look for their prey, and therefore take some precautions and be vigilant in terms of protecting yourself. You know, one of the reasons I think that serial murder in particular has gone down is because people have become more vigilant. You don't have people hitchhiking across the country the way you once did. And I think that that has contributed to it. So yeah, at one level, I think true crime programming can serve an excellent purpose in terms of understanding how these people operate, what their patterns are, and how to take some precautions in your own behavior. But at another level, and this is, you know, it gets more sociological, these stories that you see, particularly on the classic shows like 48 Hours and 2020 and Dateline, they're like these little 60-minute morality plays, you know, if you think about it. And something horrible happens, someone's killed, abducted, whatever, and then throughout the next 60 minutes, you're on this twisting, turning journey of trying to figure out who done it. But by the end of the hour, you have closure, and truth and justice generally prevails, and the individual is apprehended and locked up. So you get to feel safe at the end of the hour. So it serves a purpose of allowing us to sort of explore our own fears, our own worst emotions, and do it in a safe and controlled environment where by the end, you know, as I say, justice prevails and we can go to sleep and you know, sleep well at night. Without trying to get socio-political, we live in an environment now where a lot of people are afraid. Tremendous amount of alienation, tremendous amount of anger, frustration, fear. Many people don't feel like they have much control of their own destiny, their own lives. But if you watch one of these true crime shows, at least for 60 minutes, the world seems to make sense. There's a sense of control, and once again, enclosure, and truth, justice, and the American way prevails by the end of the hour. So I think it does serve a comforting purpose. I'm sure, as you guys have, I've talked to programmers at the various networks, and they say that they're very aware of that. They want to send the message that the system works, that you are safe, you feel safe at the end of the 60-minute hour. And that's particularly true for, I think, for women. And as you guys well know, the true crime audience, so much of the audience are, you know, are females. And I think females in particular, there's a desire to feel safe, to want to feel safe. So yeah, I think it serves multiple purposes.
Yeah, well, I think you kind of explained my next question about being a guilty pleasure, but I'll wrap that into the other question where it is a guilty pleasure for those women, that demographic, and also, but there is the level of a groupie phenomenon that happens. I mean, you have these crime cons, I should say, that pop up. You know, there's one in the U.S. We actually just got invited to one in Long Island that's coming up. And then there's one in the U.K., which is very popular. What can you speak about that for that type of person who is become a groupie of all of these stories that we're putting out there that, you know, normally people read the news back. Way back when, people would just read the newspaper to get their fill of crime, you know, and in back of it, they used to have all the crimes. There was a crime page in every local paper at the back, you know, who got arrested for what and who got DUI and who got domestic disturbance, and all those things would be listed. But now it's everywhere. It's everywhere. It's in Reddit. It's in the newspapers. It's on television. Networks are building their programming schedules around it. Networks that, you know, Oxygen in particular was just a female network before they went true crime, and they switched it completely. And a lot of other networks are doing the same thing. So talk a little bit about how people become and why they become groupies to this phenomenon of true crime.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you touched on a lot of stuff there that we could probably spend hours talking about. And the fascination with true crime is nothing new. I mean, you know, there were the pulp magazines in the 20s and 30s, and then in the 80s along came the granddaddy true crime shows, Dateline and 48 Hours and all of that. But now you got the internet and you got these web sleuths that embed themselves into the crimes themselves and the investigations. So the media, the proliferation of media and the change in the technology has allowed people who are casually involved and are interested in true crime to really delve into it, go down the rabbit hole, so to speak, and delve into it. And just as there's before, I was describing the spectrum of murder and then serial killers on the extreme end. And it's like a spectrum from, you know, someone who might kill someone in a bar fight all the way up to BTK, who is a premeditated predator. It's same thing here. You know, you've got the casual fan, you've got the really obsessive fan, and then ultimately people like the groupies. The guilty pleasure aspect of it, without a doubt. In fact, I had a woman say to me once, she said, you know, it's kind of like ice cream. She said, you know, I might eat a pint of Haagen-Dazs at 3 o'clock in the morning in bed, but I'm not going to tell anybody I did it. You know, well, it's kind of the same thing with true crime and even serial killers. You know, some people become actually gleeful, you know, when you mention Ted Bundy and Jeffrey Dahmer and BTK, you know, they mean downright gleeful, but they know at some level, this is not exactly politically correct. And they do feel a bit awkward when talking about it to their loved ones and people who don't share that perspective, which is, again, why the crime cons are there. You know, this is for the really obsessive folks, the lovers, the birds of a feather flock together. Now, the groupies, they are, as I said, on the extreme end. And I've talked to other experts about this. And I think these individuals are searching for something. Something I think, a lacking of self-esteem within them, within themselves. By associating with a Manson, BTK has lots of fans, believe it or not. He's, not the most handsome guy in the world. He wasn't Ted Bundy, but he has lots of fans out there. That these individuals, by latching on to them, it makes them feel special. If you start corresponding with a Bundy or a Raider, it makes you feel special. And especially for women, then you get into the bad boy phenomenon. He may be a bad boy, but he's my bad boy. I'm the only one that really understands him. We're confidants. So it makes them feel special. Celebrities sort of in their own right. And some of these groupies do become somewhat celebrities. Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, married one of his own groupies. Manson, shortly before he died, was supposedly going to marry Star, one of his young groupies. Mm-hmm. It's a platform for some celebrity status in their own right. I think also some people just like to inject themselves into the crimes themselves. So by associating with these individuals, maybe they'll find some inside information from a BTK that no one else knows. You know, maybe he'll drop a nugget that no one else knows. So again, it makes me special. I'm unique because I have this this information. These are individuals who are looking for something. They have a need. It's their 15 minutes of fame, to use the Andy Warhol analogy. Just briefly mention not only the groupies, but then you got the collectors too. You know, you've got the folks that collect the artifacts and the form, the belongings, things that were once held by these infamous killers. And they have their own black market and subculture network where they sell these things among themselves. And it's a similar thing. I think it makes you, to the extent that you own something that was once held by Ted Bundy or even his hair clippings, they sell hair clippings from these individuals from prison. It makes you special. Something unique that no one else has. Yeah.
Yeah, I would use a different word other than special, but that's just me.
What would you use?
I don't know. I think it's a little crazy. I really do.
Well, among themselves,
I think it's a little crazy. Special. I mean, we've met enough people who have relationships with serial killers and girlfriends and people in prison. I mean, it's definitely a psychological
Stockholm syndrome
web. It's a weird thing to want to gravitate to. But
yep. I've spoken to some of these collectors and groupies as well, and they don't like to be called groupies. I'll tell you that.
Oh, no, they're serious about it. They're serious about it. Yeah,
absolutely. That's a story for another day, another episode, because we should get some of those folks on and talk to them. I think that would be fascinating.
Yeah, that would be good. Yeah, we can. They're usually more than willing to talk. That's
absolutely.
The good, interesting.
Absolutely. And there are actually websites. There are actually websites, serialkiller.net. There are websites dedicated to the sale of this merchandise and crazy stuff.
Yeah, I know. We've seen it. This has been fascinating. So you're amazing and we love your work. And all of this is really a great deep dive into this stuff.
And yeah, the work that you've done with these, examining all these notorious serial killers. I mean, we can't wait to get into the David Berkowitz and the others. And, you know, we've been focusing on BTK right now, but, you know, there's a lot of information that you have about Berkowitz, which we're excited to hear about. Thanks for sharing it, and we'll keep this train running and talking to you and kind of learn even more about what goes on inside these people's minds and hearing it from other people, and it's just fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
Sounds good.
Next time on Partners in True Crime.
Over the next few weeks, we will be focusing on one of the world's most notorious serial killers, Dennis Rader, or how he liked to be called, BTK, because he bound, tortured, and killed his victims.
We will be talking to Jenny Grafham, the correctional officer who was in charge of him in prison, and Detective Tim Ralph, who was on the task force who captured BTK.
Then later on, we will have an exclusive two-part incredible interview with BTK's daughter, Carrie Rawson, who opened up to Dr. Bond and us on what it's been like to have to live with the horrible sins of her father.
We will also dive deep into the minds of serial killers with guests Mark Olshanker, co-author of the seminal book Mindhunter, and Dr. David Kevin Dutton, who writes and specializes in the study of psychopaths.
It's going to be an interesting and exciting journey, and we are looking forward to you joining us every Wednesday on Partners in True Crime, The Killing Hour with Doc Bond. All rights reserved. This has been a production of 722 Media Content.